Administrator for OMAP, continuing the OHP public overview. Enter and sign in, please.
I'll take the shorter chair here.
Whatever you do, talk right into the microphone, as you know. These are tough.
I'm Lim Reed, Acting Administrator of the Office of Medical Assistance Programs within the Department of Human Services. And with me today is Jim Edge, who's the Acting Assistant Administrator of OMAP. Also with us in the audience is Judy Moore Peterson, who is the manager of our Analysis and Evaluation Unit. And there's some information in here that Judy and her staff have prepared that is very fascinating information. It's information about outcomes, comparisons, and we're assuming that in the hour and a half we have available today, we won't be able to go into that. The data is here, however, and whenever you're ready to spend some time on that, Judy will be available to present it and to answer any questions that might come up in today's presentation. I heard that one of the prerequisites for testifying, or at least getting invited back to this committee, was you had to be interesting and you had to be funny. Now, nobody can compete with Rocky King in respect to being entertaining, so I won't try to do that, but we did try to outdo Rocky in terms of the amount of paper we gave you.
Double classic.
That packet that you've been handed out.
Let me hold on.
Sure.
Half a second. We will gavel in an official quorum of the House Audit Budget Reform Committee. Please proceed.
The packet that we've handed out is intended to give you an overview of the Oregon Health Plan as it's administered within the Department of Human Services. We won't touch everything that's in the packet today in an hour and a half overview. However, we will refer to various pieces in the packet as we go through. One of the things that once there's been an opportunity to go through all the information, the objectives that we would have would be that we would be able to provide you with an understanding of what the public Oregon Health Plan is and how it evolved. What the cost factors are that are specific to the Oregon Health Plan and how they're driven by the broader health care market that you've heard about in the preceding weeks, identifying the range of cost containment actions that we've already undertaken under the Oregon Health Plan to give you some framework in terms of looking at future actions that may be identified, and then the information that Judy has prepared related to outcomes and comparative information with other states in the nation. And then some information that will help frame a discussion on how the Oregon Health Plan can be reconfigured to meet priority objectives for Oregon in the future and what we can do to be of assistance to you in that process. Jim and I will just kind of go back and forth in terms of what we're presenting. And I just want to start and spend a little bit of time talking about traditional Medicaid. What it is you have to do in order to draw down federal dollars into your Medicaid program. And I'm starting off on page 3 of the document. I think that's probably a pretty important thing for you and your considerations as you look at where your starting point might be, wanting to get that wonderful match in terms of for every dollar we spend in Oregon, generally on Medicaid, we get Oregon puts up 40 cents and the federal government puts up 60 cents. And if it's the Children's Health Insurance Program, we put up 28 cents and the federal government puts up 72 cents. That is a correction from the information Jim had shared with you last week. In order to run a Medicaid program, first let me just say that it started as a cooperative venture between the federal government and the states. It was enacted back in 1965 as Title 19 of the Social Security Act. It's intended to address certain low-income individuals and provide health coverage for those individuals. But in order to be entitled to, I'll focus first on the mandatory groups. There are lots of rules related to this program, and part of them are that include you have to serve certain people in order to get the federal dollars, and you have to provide certain services. which are commonly called mandatory categories of eligibility and mandatory services. Those mandatory categories include your temporary assistance to needy families, children under the age of 19 up to 100% of poverty, children under age 6 up to 133% of poverty, pregnant women up to 133% of poverty, SSI-eligible persons with disabilities or seniors, and foster care, children in substitute care. And then the one group that Jean talked about last week, the CAWMS, the Citizen Alien Waived Emergency Medical Program. There are other groups of people that you can cover in your Medicaid program that are optional, that Oregon also covers. But if you're looking at a base program, you have an option on whether or not you cover them. That includes pregnant women above 133% of poverty, and we currently cover to 185%. Children at a level above the levels I previously talked about. You can go as high as 200% of the poverty level, although Oregon is only up to 185%.
What do you mean you can go as high as 200? The feds will let you go as high as 200.
Right. That's correct. It's you can claim federal dollars going up to 200% of the federal poverty level for children under age 19. And there are some creative ways if you want to go higher that you can go to higher incomes.
Because that's what I was saying. I mean, if we had, you know, cough, cough, laugh, laugh, if we had the general fund, good cue. If we had the general fund, we could push that higher than 200%.
You could. The way in which you do that is to, and I don't know how much room you, how far you can push that envelope, but what you can do is disregard parts of the income. And you could say, and I'll use this as an example, I'm going to disregard a third of the income, and everybody up to 200% qualifies. So I've just taken care of that other 100% that went up to 300% of the poverty level. I don't know if you can push it that far, but I do know that you can disregard income and in that way go over that 200% maximum.
Representative Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How do you disregard a third of somebody's income? I mean, how do you do that?
By rule. That's all you have to do.
It falls into a certain classification right. That I'm assuming that the feds will allow you not
right.
to count towards.
Yeah, in the CHIP program, a number of states have done that. They've exceeded the 200%, even though they're in the group of states that can only go as high as 200%. And we're in a group that can only go up to 200%. But they've exceeded it by the disregards on income for the CHIP program. So it leaves some options for the state.
Makes perfect sense to me as the logic, or as that may sound. Do you have another question based on logic? Because if you do, we have important business to do here.
Mr. Chair, I'll meet with Linda later. Fine.
All right. to go on and talk a little bit about mandatory coverage under a Medicaid program, there are a number of services that you have to provide unless you have waivers like we currently do in Oregon. And that includes, moving on to page 4, inpatient hospital, outpatient hospital, lab and x-ray, nursing facility services for those 21 and older, physician services. The next one is an important one, early and periodic screening, diagnosis, and treatment. This is a requirement under the federal regulations that you provide anything that's medically necessary to children under age 21. And so even if your Medicaid program doesn't cover a certain optional service, you have to provide it to persons under age 21 under the federal regulations, unless, once again, you have a waiver, which we currently do. Home health services, inpatient psychiatric services for persons under age 21, and some additional services, pregnancy, family planning, emergency services for the CAWM population. Then there are... Yes.
Mr. Chair. We have a waiver that releases us from caring for children up under 21, so what do? We cut it off at 18?
Mr. Chair, Representative March, what we have is a waiver that allows us to have a benefit package that's governed by the prioritized list of health services so that we don't have to provide everything to children under the age of 21 just because it's medically necessary. Instead, it's governed by the covered conditions and treatments of the prioritized list. And so that's the waiver that we have that makes us different from other states.
But still up to 21.
But still, I mean, we do it for the entire population that we serve, all 450,000.
Thank you.
Sorry.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Caulfield.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Where are the facilities for children under 21, the nursing facilities? I think there's only one. Is that not right?
I'm a bit out of my depth. I know that it's called by the agency. It's Child Adolescent Psychiatric Residential Treatment Services. And I don't know where it or they are located, but we can get back to you with that.
The DARTS programs?
No, it's not DARTS.
Oh, it's not DARTS?
That's the day treatment. This is the residential.
There's two or three. I think Gene and Portland.
At page six,
I think it's like 24 hour care.
Maybe I can save, Mr. Chair, maybe I can save some time for Representative Dalto. There's only a couple. This is a real hole in our health care system, is a inpatient treatment for adolescents. There's only a couple in the state. I believe one's in Eugene, and there's a small one. It used to be in Roseburg. I don't know if it's still functioning or not, and in Portland. So commonly from the rest of the state, we ship kids under those centers on an availability basis, which is very limited. And you've hit upon a very shortage, a very short area for treatment for adolescent kids, not only in the Medicaid population, but the entire population of the state.
Did they get it for you?
Yes, thank you.
Page six is just the start of the list of services that are optional under a Medicaid program, and you don't have to cover them, and you can still draw down federal dollars. Some of these we wouldn't think as being too optional. This is where you see a treatment for alcohol and drug abuse services, dental services, hospice, medical supplies and equipment, mental health treatment services, organ transplant services, prescription drugs, preventive services, vision services. These are all optional services for adults, keeping in mind you would have to provide the service for someone under the age of 21.
Excuse me, Lynn.
Thank you, Chair. Lynn, I realize under the categorical eligibles we use the prioritized list. In the absence of the prioritized list, we'd have to use a medical necessity definition. Theoretically, do we have a definition? What would that cover if we reverted back to just that kind of definition?
If you turn to page 8, the next page, it starts to get at a little bit of some of the requirements in a traditional Medicaid program. And one of the bullets there is reasonable amount of services. And that's been interpreted by the federal government to be a lot of services. And so you don't have a lot of flexibility. It's generally if you cover a category of service, you cover pretty much anything that the prescribing physician or nurse practitioner might say is medically necessary and appropriate. We can have some rules in terms of things like you don't have to cover, for example, cosmetic surgery or services. But to give you a graphic example of what you might have to cover, if a state elects to cover prescription drugs, then you don't have the option to say we're not going to cover Viagra. When Viagra first came out, states didn't want to cover that drug, and they were told, no, you cover drugs, therefore you will cover that drug. Now, Oregon doesn't happen to cover that particular drug because of our prioritized list, and treatment for that type of sexual dysfunction is low on the list and unfunded. Therefore, we don't have to cover the drug. But in a traditional program, we would. Other things that govern, your program has to be statewide. You can't do different things in different areas of the state. Your benefits have to be comparable across all of your eligibility groups and across the state. Clients have to have freedom of choice to go to any medical provider who will accept the medical card, unless you have waivers, once again. You can't discriminate based on a person's condition. Where you say, well, we won't cover this for someone who has a mental health diagnosis, but we would cover it for someone else. You can't have those kinds of distinctions. And you also have to have payments that are sufficient to ensure client access to providers. Now, that's pretty wide open in terms of what that may mean, and we may be faced with looking at that as we move forward in the future.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Belfield.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Lynn, are there any requirements for physicians to take the Medicaid cards? Do they have to accept the Medicaid cards?
Mr. Chair and Representative Dalto, no, they do not. And so one of the really plus benefits for us in terms of managed care is that when we enter into contracts with managed care plans, the plans, one of the conditions of that contract is that the plans provide access to care. And so through that way, we've gotten broad participation. And when there are issues in terms of not enough providers in a community willing to see Medicaid clients, it becomes a plan issue, a community issue, and the community comes together to find a way to provide access.
Are you going to talk more about access later in your presentation?
I am going to talk about the delivery system later, although I wasn't going into great detail, but would be glad to discuss any particular issue. At this point, I'd like to turn it over to Jim to talk about how we moved from this beginning point of what you have to do in a Medicaid program and came to the Oregon Health Plan.
Okay. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Jim Edge. I'm the...
Let me back up half a second. Not necessarily speaking to Viagra, but that question raised this question in my mind. I didn't think under a federal Medicaid minimum that you needed to provide prescription coverage. Yet you were saying that other states...
If you do.
But so if you do as a state elect to provide prescription drug coverage, Viagra has to be included.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. And all 50 states elect to cover prescription drugs.
In some
Does
form
make
or another.
It makes a lot of medical sense not to.
Right. Right. Okay. Excuse me.
However, Mr. Chair, by the same token, we were able to exclude Viagra by the prioritized list. You could ask for a waiver to exclude drugs specifically, too.
We certainly could ask for a waiver.
Right. I mean that's another way to get away from paying for things. I mean, if a state had a list of drugs, Viagra seems to be something Representative Westland is keenly interested in.
No, I brought that.
For whatever reason. I mean, if we thought, you know, this is not the best use of our dollars, we could petition for a waiver to exclude a drug or class of drugs to allow us to focus more where we perceive the real need to be, correct?
That is correct. Don't know how flexible CMS would be, the federal government, but they seem to be more flexible today than they have been in the past.
Thank you.
And so in general theory, what Representative Cruz is asking about is probably true.
Right. It's probably true. It is definitely true that we can ask for the waiver.
Right.
And I don't have a sense of what the odds are in terms of approval.
Depends on the request and all
right.
kinds of stuff. Anyway.
There's been 300 waivers in the last 2 years, so the chances are getting higher.
Jim, I interrupted you. I apologize.
No problem. I'm the acting assistant administrator for OMAP. I had to write that in the corner of the page here to remember that.
Yeah, I had to read it off the page.
I'm relatively new in that position, so that's why I had to do that. And luckily, Lynn gave me some of the less complicated parts of the presentation today, so hopefully I can make it through. I'm going to talk a few minutes about what we now call the Oregon Health Plan. Before the Oregon Health Plan, there were some identified problems in our healthcare system. There was a problem with the allocation of healthcare resources. People who qualified for the Medicaid program were given generous benefits while others received nothing in terms of benefits. Employer-sponsored insurance had good benefits. There were 400,000 Oregonians who were caught in the middle and did not have health care. In 1987, a process began where a group of citizens began to address this issue, and they addressed three basic questions. I'm on page 10, by the way, of the handout. They addressed the issue of who should be covered by a program which would be a Medicaid-type program. What should be covered, and how should it be financed and services delivered? The concept of universal access to a basic level of health care was important to the group as they began to discuss this. There was a focus on care for those in poverty. There was a focus on providing a basic level of health care. There was use of a publicly debated process, and there was use of the concept of services which are effective and appropriate, and that later evolved into our prioritized list of health care. Moving on to page 13 of the handout, the goals of what came out of that process in developing a program for Oregon called the Oregon Health Plan were to, one, reduce the percentage of Oregons without health coverage, to contain the rate of growth of health care expenditures, to eliminate cost shifting, to improve the quality of care, and to promote accountability. The program as it was developed had three basic components or three legs: the private market programs, insurance programs. There was the employer mandate, which was later repealed, but originally was a critical component of the program. And the public programs, starting with Medicaid and later the CHIP program was added, the Children's Health Insurance Program. Oregon received waivers. I'm on page 15 of the handout now. The waivers were negotiated with the federal government and agreed upon, and the program began in 1994. Some of the basic components of that waivered program, which became a what's called a demonstration project, was to make Medicaid available to most people living in poverty. Oregon chose to cover all people up to 100% of the federal poverty level, to provide benefits based on a priorities list of health care, which was our prioritized list that we're famous or infamous for throughout the nation, to reimburse managed care plans at rates necessary to cover reasonable costs.
Excuse me, Jim.
Thank you, Chair. On the prioritized list, have any other states pursued a similar kind of model of prioritizing, or is that just Oregon at this point?
Mr. Chair and Rick, I'm not aware that any other state has a prioritized list of health care like Oregon does. Other states are very interested in our prioritized list. Other states are asking for copies of it, and it's actually a model that universities use in their teaching programs, and it's a well-known model throughout the nation, but I'm not aware that any other state is using the model.
Representative Bates.
I'll embellish if I might, Mr. Chair. The prioritized list has been looked at heavily by foreign countries and other states, and actually is partially implemented in some other countries, New Zealand, Australia, and it's in the Russian Constitution somehow. Don't ask me how it got there. But
Bill Sizemore lives over there, too.
Well, Lars Lonsky lives there, too, but that's a different program. The main reason I believe it hasn't been picked up is because the federal government, and I'm sure you're going to comment on this, has blocked us using the list the way it should have been used. That's to raise up the line. And we have indication that we probably could move it up now, 20 or 30 lines, which hopefully we'll get the numbers for someday and know what that substantial savings might be. If, in fact, we can start using it that way, I would expect other states might look at it and start using it. But right now, it's a tool that helps us do capitation rates, but little else. And doesn't really fulfill the desire of it, which was to reduce costs by reducing services and better defining the package.
And I do want to come back to the comment you made, Representative Bates, about pricing what we might save in terms of moving the line on the prioritized list. The Health Services Commission has developed a list for, as it does every biennium, for 0305, which will be presented to the legislature. And they've spent particular, they paid particular attention to what's the lines that likely you could have some line movement on. And it looks quite a bit different in lines 500 through 560 or so now from what it did, what the current list looks like, the O103 list looks like. The medical directors of the managed care plans have looked at the 0305 list, and they do believe that it makes some medical sense that you could have a reasonable benefit package and move the line somewhere between 25 and 35 lines. Now, we don't have the official pricing from the actuary yet, but the preliminary work that we were able to do would indicate that if you moved on the new list, if you moved 30 lines, it would save about 1.2% in terms of our expenditures for health care. And that would be, if that were a 24-month period, somewhere around $47 million total funds. So the state savings would be 40% of that number. So there is some potential for savings looking at the new list, and I think some good likelihood that we can get CMS, the federal government, to buy into a line movement. Devil
but
in the
that's
detail.
Round numbers, 9-10 million general fund.
It'd be
1% 900 million.
Closer to 20 million general fund on 20 million general fund on $50 million total funds.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Merkley.
Question. Thank you. When we apply to these waivers, is it a group within the Health and Human Services Department that decides, and are they deciding based upon, do they have a lot of flexibility, or do they have a group of lawyers saying this does or doesn't meet the legal parameters issued by Congress? So is it rules that are defining it? Is it just the bureaucrat's decision? Is it law that's guiding it? What's the source of flexibility or the lack of flexibility within the federal government on this?
All of those things come into play, including politics. When we submit a waiver request, an amendment request, it goes through a bureaucratic process that has folks whose daily job it is looking at it, and they make recommendations. They convene expert panels depending upon what the issue is, and they have done that related to line movement on the list. It works through an approval process. It includes attorneys, the Department of Justice, I don't know if it's Department of Justice or if it's HHS attorneys. It includes the Office of Management and Budget. It works its way all the way through the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. It then goes on up to the Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services for sign-off, depending upon what the issue is, if it's something substantive. If it's just a minor change we want to make to our demonstration, then those approvals are likely to take place at a lower level. And sometimes it goes to the White House. It has in the past anyway, in terms of the political implications.
Mr. Chair, if I can pursue that for a minute. I look at this and go, who really cares if Oregon has a few less treatments and covers a few more people? And apparently a lot of people care. But I don't have any sense of that. Why would something go to the White House on something like this?
There is, Oregon was looked at, with some real trepidation in terms of when we first moved forward with the concept of a priority list, and we were branded with rationing as a negative word. And so there has been a lot of national attention over the years, and even the Department of Justice, U.S. Department of Justice, weighed in terms of the process we used to do our prioritization, as they found it contrary to federal law and the Americans with Disabilities Act. And we worked through that process with them. In the intervening years, CMS has remained very concerned, in particular because when we make a choice to cover or not cover something on the list, they're concerned about the not cover. It affects our entire Medicaid population, and they care about those mandatory eligibles. They don't want to reduce services to children and pregnant women and people with disabilities and seniors. So they're particularly focused on that. CMS has agreed, though, as we got our new waivers that Jim's about to move into on the OHP2, they have agreed that under the new administration, that they should rely more upon the decision-making process that's gone on in Oregon. And so they've agreed to work with us to develop a more streamlined process for approvals related to the prioritized list. Now, you know, we've been in that dialogue off and on over several months, and I don't think we've made substantial progress right now because we kept throwing them new things. We had an 8-line movement we wanted. We had a 35-line movement that was with them for a while for this biennium. But now they're ready to turn their attention to developing the streamlined process. And it's that process we hope to have in place as we move forward what may come out of this body for 0305.
One more follow-up here. Thank you. This issue over rationing is a little hard for me to get my hands around because every insurance plan rations. It says, yes, you're covered for this, and no, you're not covered for that. But did this essentially get caught up in the politics around single-payer health insurance and Hillary Clinton's group, or is that really what drove the lack of flexibility?
I don't think so. I don't think that was a particular issue. It was more that the status quo provided very good benefits for the entitled population. And what we were trying to do in Oregon was expand to a broader population and to say we would fund that partially by providing a different benefit package, with our focus being on the benefits that do the most good, they're the most effective. And that was just CMS and others kept getting hung up on the status quo. They would look at that and say it's not as good as the status quo and not look to this group of folks who had nothing.
I think the operative word there, not to contradict you, and said different, I think the operative word is reduced benefits, taking that money, matching with federal dollars, and expanding eligible. Mm-hmm. Is that a fair classification?
Yes and no, because when we went through the prioritization process and the Health Services Commission ultimately came up with its prioritized benefits and the funding line was drawn by the legislature, there were some benefits that were no longer covered, but there were new benefits that we had not previously covered. Transplants, most organ transplants for adults we hadn't previously covered. Dental services for adults. Preventive services for adults. So we did add things as well. And move to what some people might think was a better benefit package. And I'm sure Representative Bates has something to say on that.
Yeah, we did that in anticipation that we knew Viagra was coming down the line. So, I mean, that's why we did that. Representative Bates.
Just to complete the Viagra story, I remember sitting at a meeting of the Health Service Commission many years ago at a Catholic church on the coast of Oregon, looking at the prioritized list and finding out that the sexual dysfunction line that Viagra had fallen under was, in fact, at that point above the line, and we revised the list and moved it below the line. And it just felt strange doing that inside that church. Okay? I never felt good about that at all. I want to ask a kind of a tough question. I'm not quite sure how to phrase this, and so I'll try to get to the point I'm trying to get to if I can here. The list is in place today, and it eliminates a few and maybe more than a few services that normally would have been previously covered by a Medicaid program. But the world has changed the last 12 years, and while we were one of the first or maybe the first state to get the waivers to start doing things our own way in Oregon, other states now are doing more things than we are in some areas, and many waivers have been granted. We kind of broke the dike on getting waivers away from the Medicaid program. The question in my mind is not so much as can a list save us more money, because it can save us a little bit incrementally, but does it have any value to define the package anymore? By that I mean, in comparison to other states, does the package that is offered to the Medicaid recipients in this state significantly different than others? And does the prioritized list still save us that money? The question is, should we keep using it or not? If we don't use it anymore, do we have an actual increase in costs, or should we replace it with something else that defines the package a different way, and that will even save us more money but maintain a basic health care package for these people? And that's a pretty tough question to answer, but we should have experience from other states and what they've done now, too.
And I don't have a direct answer for you. Indeed, there has been a lot of experimentation that's gone on in the intervening years, and we're not necessarily right out in front anymore, although we may still be to some, to a large degree, related to the prioritized list and mandatory populations in any case. Just anecdotally, one of the medical directors of one of our managed care plans has indicated that use of the prioritized list probably makes a difference of about 20% in terms of cost. Now, that's a plan that does some significant management, medical management of its enrollees, but and makes effective use of the list. I haven't heard other plans say that it's a 20% impact. Over the years, we've talked about it being 10%, but I don't have anything that quantifies that today because we don't cover those services anymore. But a part of what we're going to look at in response to one of the questions from last week is the richness of our benefit package compared to some other states. That may begin to get a little bit of information on the issue.
To follow up, Mr. Chair. The last time I saw this figure was over 3 years ago, so I may be wrong, but at that time, the amount of money we expended per individual in the Oregon Health Plan ranked us 46th or 47th in the United States. In other words, there were 45 or 46 states that spent more than we did per individual, and some of those numbers were substantially larger than ours, double or triple. Do we still rank very high as far as expenditure per individual? And secondly, do you have any idea if the prioritized list has impacted that at all, helped it, or is it just an immaterial finding that is more the result of our overall healthcare delivery system and the result of managed care?
Very high or very low?
You meant low.
Low.
Very low. We rank very low.
Right.
And we still do.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Moving into some of Judy's information, on page 63, if you look at the chart on the right-hand side, you can see that we rank 44th in terms of our Medicaid expenditures per Medicaid client. This was as of 2000. But it is a combination of all the things you mentioned. And also, this Medicaid national data includes long-term care, and we have low long-term care costs compared to other states. If you turn to the next page, you can see how, you know, we're still 44th in the nation, but you can see how some of the other states that have demonstrations, who've done health care reform, where they rank in terms of their spending per client. And many of those demonstrations states are spending more per person than Oregon. With only Oklahoma, Hawaii, and Tennessee being below us.
Could we go back to 63?
1963.
I wasn't even born then. How old were you?
I had hair.
Medicaid wasn't born then either.
That's right.
And that's my question. On the left-hand side of the page, we've got Western states' Medicaid expenditures, and I look at Colorado, with, you know, approximately $418. Then you go over to the Western states' ranking of Medicaid expenditures per eligible. How does Colorado spend almost $1,000 more than the U.S. average when they are below the U.S. average in Medicaid expenditure?
Well,
how do they do that?
The chart on the left represents your Medicaid expenditures per state resident, kind of getting it to that issue maybe of the tax burden. And so they may cover a significantly smaller portion of their population, so overall their tax burden is less when you look at it across the entire population, whereas when you look over to the right, they spend more on the people they do cover. That may be one explanation. Judy, are there others that we could address here?
Am I wrong that Colorado's population is approximately what ours is? You know, around our similar demographics, one big city, lots of rural.
They're about a million bigger, I think.
Yeah.
But
the question is, how many people do they cover in their Medicaid program?
Right, they cover fewer.
So this is an eligibles issue, not a
right.
benefits issue.
In this particular case, that's what this would lead me to think.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, a very key question, though, you brought up. Does this include long-term care facilities? And
it does include long-term care, is that correct?
All Medicaid expenditures.
Mr. Chair, we've really got to cut that out. I mean, that does not give us something that's meaningful here. because Medicaid payments for long-term care facilities is probably half the budget, or close to it, I would guess. Is that correct?
I do know that that portion of our agency that handles long-term care, their general fund is about the same as OMAP's general fund, so that
my
would
point.
Lead me that way.
And further than that, the system we use in Oregon is substantially different than anything else in the United States. That really skews these numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Can you cut these numbers out if you have the OMAP only?
Can we pull long-term care?
Well, look.
But I agree with you. I think that's a
yeah.
I mean, how much are we spending on functionally take out the long-term care portion of Medicaid, which would require, okay, we've got to cover that to get the waiver. That's a key question.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how much are we spending on, you know, the average citizen that you would traditionally think of as, you know, falling into this safety net of, oops, I'm sick, I've got to go get medical attention, as opposed to long-term care needs? I think that's a fundamental question.
Yeah. I would suspect we also have a higher long-term care population percentage-wise than Colorado because we have an older population.
Mm.
General.
I mean, I guess in a different state demographics, and
yeah.
We're just going to get that out.
Yeah, I mean, this is apples to apples,
right.
But we want to compare oranges to oranges.
Right.
Mr. Chair.
Judy and her staff will look to see whether or not we can do that. The information we've presented in previous biennia has included the long-term care information because that was what was available to us on a national basis.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Also, when this says per eligible, and I'm guessing states have different ratios of the number of eligibles who actually access the program. For example, in California, I see California very low, 51st. I'm guessing, and maybe you can fill us in, that there is a large immigrant population that isn't that is eligible but doesn't sign up for the program. And so that would drive it to a very low level per eligible. Is that a factor? And can we get the numbers not per eligible but per participant, if you will? Does that
actually
change it?
Per eligible is misleading. This is per participant.
Per participant.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Let me spend a little time on this. Wouldn't it be one and the same? I mean, maybe you're not covering everybody.
And then is that what you're driving at, people out there not knowing?
Yeah, people not knowing, not signing up, and therefore they don't cost anything to the program even though they were ineligible, although you've clarified that you're not counting those.
And there are a significant number of folks in Oregon who could qualify today who have not come in the door and enrolled in the program.
Gives me no end of pleasure to be able to say we have two doctors on this committee. So when Bates blows out, we can still call on Representative Dr. Anderson.
We are the tail that's wagging the dog in dentistry. It seems incredible to me that there can be such a difference across the nation in terms of the amount spent per. Is that totally political? Or are there reasons, can we, by waiver, ask for more? We're a poor state, we're an older state, therefore make your...
Don't go there, Gordon.
You know, we could raise, we could cover more services, we could increase our payment rates. We can pay more per eligible and draw down federal dollars for it. It just means we have to put up our 40%, right.
Can't change the percentage.
No, the one of the things that we were going to provide to you coming out of last week is some information on the criteria that the federal government uses in determining those match rates. And it is driven by the economy of your state compared to the nation as a whole. And so we don't have an opportunity directly to influence those.
Is that a question?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I came in the last few moments of your question. I'd like to sort of take a moment here to think about some of the things that are different about Oregon that might be driving these figures. One, our long-term care program is a model for the rest of the country, and it probably runs at a cost much lower than most states. Most states, generally speaking, what happens when you need long-term care, you go to an extended care facility at $3,000 or $4,000 a month. The programs we have, Oregon Project Independence, ELF homes, those things just are not present in other states. They just aren't there, and so they actually end up spending more per individual. However, you'll find a lot of those people who would normally be in our ALF homes might be living in shanties or in terrible conditions in other states. And that's something we've chosen not to do to this point. And so you have to look at the overall budget for those people as well as the individual price. We need to take that piece out of this because that's not our concern in this community. Our concern here is the health care system, and that's why it's so important to cut that out. When you look at our health care system in the state, you see a very similar situation, though. Oregon, along with the other western states, delivers the same quality of health care as the eastern states do at a substantially less price. I think of the state for hospitalization, for certain diseases such as pneumonia, congestive heart failure, the amount of time you spend in the intensive care unit after a heart bypass is substantially lower and cheaper in Oregon than back east with the same outcomes. So some of what we do here and what we see here may not be, and to be honest about it, may not be because of the Oregon Health Plan, but because the overall health care system is fairly efficient compared to other states. And I just want to put that caveat out there so that, you know, we put blame where it belongs and credit where it belongs, but we try to get to an answer of where we want to go. I'll stop here, Mr. Chair.
But, I mean, the shortened hospital stays, similar outcomes, is a condition you can describe for, as a rule, Western medicine. And in these charts, I mean, we've got all Western states here.
Although on the next page you have something that spreads across.
But I just wanted, yeah, I still think, you know, that's why I appreciate you having the Western states here. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, you're trying to get it to truer comparison.
Well, and I also, I know Ellen didn't mean to say we don't care about long-term care. We want to.
No, I didn't mean that.
we do care about that, but we want to know what part it plays
here.
In the cost here. Yes.
Our focus here.
Yeah. Capsules
for Baptists.
Thank you.
Thank you for correcting.
Lynn, I want to compliment you because I know this might seem a little herky-jerky for you in terms of your presentation, but in terms of the committee and the part of what we're here for, the dissemination of information and perspective, this is extraordinarily helpful. So,
great. We're at your disposal.
We're doing good.
Maybe just one more comment, too, about where this conversation started and why did the feds care so much and why are they so restrictive about what they allow us to do and don't allow us to do. We have to remember that the feds put up 60% of the funding for this program, and actually more than that if you consider the CHIP program, too. And they do feel like this is partly their program, and they feel like they should have a say in what happens and how we run it. And they are relatively paternalistic about the program, especially about the categorical eligibles. They feel it's their job to protect those people. They are very restrictive with a very complicated set of regulations that govern how we run the program.
Somewhat like our attitude when we're talking to our counties.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You bet. And it's specifically those regulations that we get waivers from when we enter into a demonstration project with waivers.
Yeah.
Right. Some of the, I think, national numbers we see shows something like 20, maybe a quarter of Medicaid recipients using maybe three quarters, 70% of the resources on a national level. I know a lot of that's blind, disabled, aged. Do we know in Oregon how those numbers kind of break out compared to the national? Are we spending a proportionate high number of Medicaid dollars on a smaller population? Of course, and that begs the question about long-term care versus the somatic health.
We'll look and see whether or not we can get something for you. I don't think Oregon would be particularly dissimilar from the nation in that respect. When you have a smaller group of folks who have the greatest medical need, that's where your costs are going to concentrate. But we'll see if there's any information specific to Oregon that could be looked at against some national data.
Well, I don't know who we were so consistently interrupting, but I think it was Jim. Please proceed, sir.
I have just a little bit more to say in this section. I'm going to talk about...
What page are we on? After we've
page 16.
All right.
I'm going to talk a little bit about changes in the Oregon plan most recently. Coming out of the last legislative session, there was a bill passed and direction given to DHS to proceed with a restructuring of the Oregon Health Plan that we now call OHP 2, Oregon Health Plan 2. the problems that led to OHP, the need for OHP 2, was that we were seeing caseload and inflationary costs increasing. We were seeing that the federal government wasn't giving us the flexibility that we thought we had in the original Oregon Health Plan, as has already been mentioned. They were not allowing the line movement on the prioritized list that we thought we had negotiated with them when we negotiated the original waivers. And the employer mandate had not been implemented. So we looked at a set of new waivers. The goals of the restructuring were identified as an attempt to get a better control over costs, get more flexibility with the federal government so that we could impose cost sharing and benefit changes and eligibility caps, hopefully without the federal government having to give their prior approval to every little change we wanted to make. We wanted to get also the ability to draw down federal dollars to support private market programs, particularly the FEOP program. And Rocky, I know, has already been before you and talked about where he's going with that new ability that he has in the FEOP program. We got in those waivers an ability to expand coverage above 100% of the federal poverty level as funding is available. At this point, we're not seeing the funding available, and we haven't expanded above 100% of the federal poverty level, but we have that flexibility to do so now. And we wanted to address the issue of the sustainability of the Oregon Health Plan. Is it sustainable into the future? We thought we got enough flexibility to make it sustainable into the future. It turns out we didn't. We didn't anticipate the extent of the economic downturn. And so we're in a situation again now where it's bought us a little time, but it's not sustainable into the future with the current program. The OHP2 program, as it currently operates, involves different benefit packages, one called OHP Standard, which is for the what we call the expansion population, the population that's not categorically eligible according to federal standards, the population that we cover in Oregon simply because of the fact that they are below the federal poverty level because of their low income, and a program called OHP Plus, which is the current benefit package for the traditional Medicaid categorical eligibles. With OHP2, we got flexibility to reduce the benefits without getting federal prior approval. We got flexibility to cap enrollment. We got flexibility to charge copayments, which are mandatory copayments now rather than the optional copayments that the federal government normally allows a program to impose. We got the ability to charge premiums, and that's a graduated system of premiums that we've imposed, and it includes an uninsurance requirement for 6 months. You've already heard from Rocky about the FEOP part of the program, which we also received.
Hold on a second, Jim.
Yes.
On this reference to higher premiums, are we talking about the expanded or the expansion categories or the traditional categories or both?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Merkley, we're talking about the expansion population.
Okay.
The traditional categorical eligibles are not under the premium requirements, but the expansion population is, you know, on a graduated scale.
What is the monthly premium for the expansion categories?
Page 50 of the handout, I think we have a list of those premiums. Ranges from $6 at the lowest end of the income scale. We're presently only covering up to 100% of the federal poverty level, so that's a $20 premium, monthly premium, for those people who are from 85 to 100% of the federal poverty level.
Several of us have heard about those premiums.
Just one of those trade-off issues.
I'm going to turn it back over to Lynn at this point and let her cover the next section.
All right.
Representative Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you comment, if you could, real quickly on the difference, the actual difference in the benefit packages between OHP Plus and the package for OHP Standard? I know it's actuarially 20 or 25% less.
23, I think.
22%.
Right.
What that savings really is. And I'd also like to know, if possible, if we were to get a waiver to, say, impose that package on OHP plus, what the savings to the state would be.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bates, the OHP standard benefit package was designed to be at 78% of the actuarial value of the benefit package provided to OHP Plus. You're right. And in order to reach that goal, there was a combination of reduced services and the client contributions in the forms of copayments and premiums. And the task was given to the Health Services Commission to design a prioritized list, not of condition treatment pairs, but of services. And they did that in groups of services, identifying those services that are mandatory requirements of the Medicaid program, the federal Medicaid program, at the top of the list, and moving down to the less needy groups, the optional groups. And we initially identified several groups of services as to be not covered in reaching that 78% benefit package, and that was the vision services, the non-emergency transportation services, and part of the dental benefit package was identified as non-covered services. And part of the durable medical equipment package also was below the line. And then to reach the remainder of the savings that needed to be reached to make it at 78% of the value of the OHP Plus package, the copayments and premiums accomplished the rest of that saving. Since then, I'm sure you're aware that we have gone further down that list and identified as further cost savings the November Emergency Board identified the other optional packages of the remainder of dental, the remainder of DME, the mental health and chemical dependency benefits to be eliminated. And then the agency put on the table for the House Bill 5100 cuts the one remaining package of services that was an optional package of services for the OHP standard population, prescription drug benefits. And those will be eliminated on March 1st.
And that leaves a benefit package whose actuarial value is about 53% of the benefits that these clients had on January 31st. So a significant reduction, obviously.
Representative Cruz.
Well, thank you, Ms. Chair. First of all, according to House Bill 2519, the Health Services Commission was supposed to reprioritize the existing list, not create a new one, and that was somewhat controversial in the Waiver Steering Committee, and they took incredible license in what they did. Second of all, it was also very controversial in the Waiver Steering Committee. In fact, the vote was 10 to 11, or 11 to 10 in favor of accepting the copayments because actually we're balancing the books on a pure cost shift.
Copayments or premiums?
Copayments.
That's the point I was going to bring up. That's my next question.
And so, you know, I just don't want the committee to assume that everybody went swimmingly along with this. This was incredibly controversial. And having been on the losing side of those two issues, it's still kind of a bee in my bonnet.
Well, just as an editorial comment,
some things are always consistent. I am quite certain that whatever the committee comes up with will be extremely controversial as well. I mean, there aren't any easy answers here.
Representative Bates.
Yes, Mr. Chair. And I'm gonna play off Representative Cruz's comments, too. My memory of this was that most of the way of reaching the 78% initially was durables and transportation and some dental, but most of it came from copays, and the question about those copays is whether they ever be collected or whether it's just a cost shift. Copays at the physician's office, I think, are pretty straightforward. They're probably collected. Then the copays at the pharmacy, copays for hospital admission, copays for lab and x-ray are pretty controversial and never probably going to be realized. And so I had questions about the whole package from the very beginning, but I wanted to get a feel for where you thought it was coming from and a chance for us all to kind of revisit that issue so that we look at possibility of redefining a package for this whole group, that we do look at it rather globally and understand that what the Health Service Commission did, what was helpful, certainly didn't answer the question for us in a lot of ways. And I think you'd probably agree with that, Representative yes. Cruz.
And I do want to be sure and let you know that the Health Services Commission has sent a letter dated February 3rd to the governor and to Speaker Menas, Senate President Courtney, and to Senate President Pro Tem, Lynn Hannon, saying that they would like to be invited to the table to relook at this issue, that the way the benefits have played out is different than what they expected back when they did their initial work, and they're more than willing to come back and be a participant based upon all of their experience in the gathering of public input in their process. And they have, with that in mind, scheduled their next meeting to be here in Salem over at the Public Service Building on March 6th from 1 to 4. And they would welcome an opportunity to begin a dialogue and be a part of the process of looking for solutions for the future.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Bates, we're very well aware of the controversial nature of the copayments and whether they're collectible, and the fact that the Waiver Application Steering Committee had a very difficult time coming to decision on this, and it was a split vote in the final analysis. But they were trying, I think, to design a program that looked a lot like a private insurance program. So they did include benefit reductions, copayments, and premiums, because those are things that are pretty common in insurance programs. And they were trying to design something that looked a lot like the programs that are available on the FEOP side. We were matching the FEOP benefit with what was in the OHP standard benefit, and wanting to keep them somewhat equivalent in nature. They aren't anymore with the additional benefits we've had to take on the standard program, but that was part of the original intent.
Yeah, I mean, again, trade-offs, and I think it's very legitimate. One thing you didn't, I think, graciously bring up, mentioned physicians, you know, have a higher percentage or a better likelihood of collecting that copay, but at what cost? You know, how much additional aggravation, frustration, office cost in an environment that's already fairly low reimbursed, you know, do we expose the physicians to?
Just to make a quick comment to cover myself here, I'm not criticizing the Health Service Commission. They did what they were supposed to do and did the best way they could. Questions, can we go further?
Well, Mr. Chair, they didn't do what they were supposed to do, because what they did was what was spelled out in 2519 was fairly clear, and they went a different direction. So I'm not willing to accept that. But if I was willing to accept that, I guess it just bothered me that they balanced the books on cost shift rather than trying to get to true benefits, true allocations, and true costs. You know, we've heard for the last couple of weeks in this committee the fact that every time we shift cost into the private sector, we're losing coverage there. And you know, it gets down to what the chair has trying to get to in all this, is the fact that we can no longer look at Medicaid in its own universe. We have to look at the entire system, and unfortunately, up till now, we've looked at Medicaid in its own universe and been willing to shift costs to other things to balance that book.
Well, my good or bad news, depending on how you want to look at it, is we're going to get the opportunity to right that ship. So that's what we're here for.
That's why I'm sticking around.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you. Representative, could you expand on kind of the specific cost shift you're talking about here? It's in regard to the copayments. I mean, clearly it's shifting it into the pocket of the participant, but you're talking about something broader than that.
Well, Representative, for example, the $250 a day copay for hospitalization, somebody below 100% federal poverty probably is not going to be able to pay that, and so the hospital absorbs that cost. And I think what Representative Bates was talking about other testing and stuff like that, this population cannot afford those costs. They don't have the money to pay them. So since they aren't paid and they're part of the book, it's going to have to be absorbed by the provider.
This leads to a question then, if I can ask this. If the, in this type of example, when somebody doesn't pay their share of the copayment, I see under your other point here the ability to disenfranchise or disenroll the expansion population. Does that person end up essentially getting kicked out of the plan?
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, no, they do not. We do not disenroll someone for non-payment of copays. We do have a approval with CMS to disenroll someone for non-payment of premiums, but not for the non-payment of copayment.
Okay, thanks.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to do maybe a process check with you, knowing that that normally you break it at 4:30. Would it be your preference that we just continue and get as far as we get, or would you prefer that I take the remaining time to kind of walk through what's here so that you can know that in terms of picking and choosing for the future interaction?
Just keep progressing along the path, because one of the things, again, I mean, I don't apologize. I just point out that I think what is most beneficial for the committee is the give and take and these questioning, these questions as we go. I mean, we'll be able to read this on our own time, but we don't have you, you know, forever, and we appreciate you being here. So just proceed ahead, and we'll interrupt, you know, fairly frequently.
All right. Moving on to page 20. Wanted to take these next few pages to talk about today's program, who is covered. And earlier I talked about who you have to cover, and now I'm talking about who we do cover today. And I won't spend too much time with this because Jean Thorne talked about it really last week when she was here in terms of the various eligibility groups that we cover. The traditional age, blind, disabled, TANF, children, pregnant women, children in foster care. And then our new eligibles that we cover as a result of the Oregon Health Plan waivers, the Children's Health Insurance Program, where we cover kids under age 19 up to 185%. We also, although we're not here to talk about the non-Oregon Health Plan component of the program, just wanted to mention that we do have, and Jean also touched on those, we previously covered the medically needy population. That program did end January 31st, but I know it's still a subject of debate within the legislature, and I don't know where that's actually going to end, but for right now it's not covered.
Film at 11.
And we cover some Medicare beneficiaries for and some women who are screened through breast and cervical cancer programs in the state. On page 22, it's just a graphic display of our various OHP eligibility groups and what levels of poverty each group goes up to. There's wide variance in terms of how high up the income scale we go in coverage.
Ms. Chair, is that the federal poverty level
yes.
cap for TANF?
No, I think I am not knowledgeable about TANF. It has to do with your standards for assistance and cash payment levels. And so based upon what Oregon does in terms of its cash programs for TANF, that comes in at the 50% level. We'd have to bring in someone else to really talk about
it. And Ms. Chair, the reason for that question is we've had a surplus of TANF dollars because they were a block grant, and we've used them to backfill lots of other things. And so it'd be interesting to know if we're actually not serving the population there we should because of other things we are doing with the dollars.
Well, if we get into maintenance of effort issues.
Mr. Chair, could I ask
Representative Tomei.
Question? Thank you. I know what some of these things are. I don't know what PLMW is.
Sorry. The PLMW is pregnant women, poverty level medical women, PLM children. Then let's see, OAA is seniors, ADAD is aid to the blind, aid to the disabled, and then the CHIP program.
Thank you.
Thanks. luckily we're not before Ways and Means where they're going to ding us 25 cents every time we use an acronym.
No, it's a dollar here.
Oh, it's a dollar.
This is a great slide.
Lynn, could you say OAA again, please?
Old Age Assistance and Seniors, persons age 65 and above. Who meet the criteria, the income criteria, and other eligibility.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Why was there a separate CHIP program? Why wasn't it just simply an expansion of Medicaid eligibles?
The federal government decided that they wanted to have states make a concentrated effort to go out and cover more children, that the uninsurance rate was too high. They allocated special funds at the federal level. They are allotments, and there's so much money for every state that you get on an annual basis that you can access as an incentive, because you could have taken your Medicaid programs to higher levels. As an incentive, they gave the enhanced match when I talked about the 72% match versus our normal 60%. They also, though, didn't want you moving folks into that match rate that you should cover under your Medicaid program. So they put some barriers in terms of you have to look first to see if someone Medicaid categories before you could move them over. We, when ballot measure 44 passed, that was the 30-cent tobacco tax, cigarette tax increase, one of the purposes for which it was identified was an expansion of the Oregon Health Plan. And the legislature decided that they did want to expand the poverty level medical children's program and pregnant women program with some of that money. In the meantime, after they had authorized us to move forward, the CHIP legislation passed at the federal level. So we came back to the E-Board and said, hey, look at the match we can get if we move over into this program. And so the E-Board made the choice then to move over and start the CHIP program.
Mr. Chair. Representative Cruz.
Lynn, while you're explaining that, could you explain the rationale behind all of the federal decisions that have been made?
That you was don't a joke.
That was a
joke.
No. Well, and I don't think you could.
No, you're right.
That was a joke.
And the simplest answer to your good question, Representative Merkley, I mean, they're punching in. You should be covering this population anyway. We want to incent you to cover additional children's, in, you know, with a additional requirements, and we'll pay you a higher reimbursement rate to do it. I mean,
thank you.
Simplest terms. Representative Bates.
Just to flush that out, and correct me if I'm wrong, Lynn, my memory is before the SCHIP program, you know, we had about 18% of the total population in the United States uninsured, but in children, it was close to 50%. So a huge number of kids had no health insurance. And the SCHIP was designed to attack that problem. And that figure may be wrong, but I think it was pretty high.
Prior to the start of the Oregon Health Plan, the uninsurance rate for children was 22%, I think, in Oregon, across the entire child population. I don't know what it was at a certain poverty level. And then we brought it down to about 8%. So we've made an amazing accomplishment in terms of covering children, or progress.
Did CHIP come in the middle of that? What year did CHIP come in?
We implemented the CHIP program in July of 1998.
Thank you.
We have some more stuff back here that gets to dates, too. Just the next page is, although this is 2002 poverty levels, they just issued the new poverty levels for 2003 last Friday. I don't have those yet. This is the income at various poverty levels based upon your family size for reference. On page 24, some demographics. This is for our entire Medicaid program, the 450,000 eligibles. You can see distribution by age based on female, male. For children, it's pretty much evenly distributed. Then as you move into the childbearing ages, you see a greater percentage of women that are covered in the program. Looking over at race and ethnicity, we're covering more individuals in our program than the population has for a given, if you look at the total Oregon population, I don't think it would be as high as 4.5% for African American. However, for low-income individuals, we may be tracking close to what the population distribution is.
And there is more information on our website broken out at a greater level of detail on demographics, and that's available. The next set of pages is probably confusing. I probably put too many things in here, but what I wanted to do was to provide some additional information about the OHP standard clients, knowing that a lot of the discussion that you're having will focus on the 100,000 folks who get OHP standard benefits. And there are two groups of eligible in the OHP standard population, those who are parents of children and those who don't have children in their household. Both groups are ages 19 to 65, but they look very different. And so this first page, 25, are the parents of children. And you can see that obviously they're fairly concentrated in the childbearing years and disproportionately female in comparison. When you move to the next page, you're looking at the adults who don't have children in the household, page 26. And here you see that they're slightly disproportionate male compared to the other group. And so your choices as you look at where you want to go in the future, what your benefits might look like, may be different as you consider the population.
May I?
Representative Pomey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Why? Why are there more males in the 19 to 29 category?
Well, we serve a number of folks that we're serving in this group. Are individuals who have need of mental health and chemical dependency services. And to a large degree, the public health or the public safety system has used the Oregon Health Plan as a place that you can refer folks for treatment, for example, for addiction services. And so I may be speaking from a stereotype, but in my mind I've thought in terms of that there would probably be, that would be disproportionately male, and that may be part of what's reflected here. We certainly spend a lot more of our money on addiction services on our OHP standard population than we do on the population as a whole. About 50% of our dollars for addiction services go to the OHP standard clients, and they represent about a fourth of the population that we serve, of the population we serve as a whole.
Interesting. Thank you, Lynn.
Yeah.
Well, and I think also if you want to speak in, you know, stereotypical representations, I mean, the typical American family is a, you know, single woman with a child. I mean, that's becoming more the norm. So, you know, that's why I think the first slide represents with children greater percentage of women. And, you know, the second slide, adults without children, you know, you've got fathers and children that either through divorce or whatever, I mean, don't have the child in the household. It's one of the things we deal with here more and more and more, that government, the void government tries to fill. It's a very significant social trend.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to get back to your statement. You said 50% of the Medicaid expenditure dollars are on A&D?
No, I'm sorry. 50% of the A&D dollars we spend on the OHP standard population.
Thank you.
Yet they only represent a fourth of the of our Medicaid population. No, definitely not that different. Page 27 just takes those two groups and puts them together so you can see OHP standard as a whole and the distribution by age and sex. Moving on to page 28 is getting at the income issue.
Yep. Representative Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going back to the new eligible single couples, these are adults without children.
Yes.
Right.
Roughly 50. I'm just doing a quick add up here. 50,000, roughly.
I'm sorry. What?
Looks like just adding it real quickly here. It looks like about 50,000 people. Can you give us a cost analysis of what it costs the Oregon Health Plan to insure these 50,000 people?
We can provide information. Do you want it in terms of the aggregate dollars or in terms of a per member per month?
Aggregate. Thank you, Lynn.
Mm-hmm. Moving on to page 28 and getting to income. This is where you can see the skewed distribution of our population in the OHP standard groups at various income levels. whereas you look down there, 0 to 10% FPL, or federal poverty level, in terms of income. Over 50% of the adults without children in the household are in that group. And when it says 0 to 10%, that pretty much means zero. It was just that was the narrowest category we had to get to that issue. And you see a more even distribution with the families across the very, although still disproportionately in the 0 to 10%, but after that, a somewhat growing distribution showing some income growth across the population.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. That 50% at zero, that's probably almost a chronically unemployable population, I would guess. I mean, that's they're at zero because they've got chemical or mental problems that prevent them from seeking employment, and it's a vicious cycle, so they're kind of stuck there.
Yes, and certainly the adults without children in the household do have very different health profile. Their cost is much higher than it is for the families group, the parents group, which also would support that. Look at it.
Thank you.
Representative Merkley.
Thank you. I apologize for my confusion here. Is the new eligibles is synonymous with the standard
yes.
plan?
I'm sorry, this is an old slide, and that was the terminology at that point.
I see. Well, why wouldn't these people at 0 to 10% be part of the adults and families with that poverty level? Why aren't they part of the PLUS plan or the don't they fall into that definition of
well,
also?
Although they have an income that might qualify them, they don't fit into the other categorical requirements. You have to be participating in the TANF population, Temporary Assistance to Needy Families, which is a program with rules related to seeking jobs, having children in the household, although one portion of these do have children in the household. Or if you don't have children in the household, then you need to be disabled and fit in that category. Some of these people are disabled, but they haven't gone through the federal SSI disability criteria determination, sometimes by choice.
Okay, I track you now. Back to your earlier testimony that unless they fit into one of the categories, single persons and childless couples did not qualify. But these are not... Okay, that's what confused, because these are not single persons or childless couples, right? They're adults in families.
Yeah, the one that says singles, they're looking at page 28. We have adults and families. These are parents.
And that's much lower. Okay.
And then we have singles, couples, adults who don't have children in the household.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah, I mean, the simple answer is trying to bifurcate a process and drive more benefits to children or those, you know, children and parents of children. How can you treat the child without treating either the mother or the father or both? I mean, is an effort to bifurcate that benefits package is a simple answer, I think.
You know, these adults and families, the parents, their children have OHP plus, you know, and they have this reduced OHP standard benefit package. Mm-hmm. One of your choices in terms of looking at how you might reconfigure this is what you would want to do with those parents.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Getting back to slide 28 and the 0 to 10% population, or 0 to 10% of the FPL, I'm trying to think, what are the reasons why some people do not want to go on SSI? Does SSI have better benefits? I mean, it certainly would save the state money unless the Bush plan comes out where they'll give us all that money. At least that's what I read in the paper yesterday, and let us decide what we want to do with the money. But what are the reasons? Do you know?
I don't specifically know. I would conjecture here, and perhaps we can get someone from the eligibility part of our agency who works directly with clients in terms of the eligibility process to provide some information that would profile a little bit some of the choices that people are making.
Be nice if we could follow up.
I mean, if they really are chronically disabled, I'd rather get them on SSI.
Representative Moniz-Anderson, one of the things that we do know is that it takes something like 2 years to go through the process of getting SSI determination of disability.
Yeah.
And it's a long, complicated process, and some people, I think, just choose not to go through that process if they can get a health benefit without going through the process.
Follow up? Are there ombudsmen to assist with that process, or no?
The federal process, and we don't get too involved in that, although we do have a state process that looks at what's called a presumptive SSI eligibility determination, and it's not run by our agency. It's run by Seniors and People with Disabilities, but they are doing a high level look at disability, and if it is determined that they are presumptively eligible, if they're almost positive that they will fall into that disability category, they are given a classification that does give them the OHP plus benefit package rather than the OHP standard benefit package while they're awaiting their two-year process of getting the federal determination.
Okay.
Although I don't want to mislead you about that. States have an option, and I'm not particularly knowledgeable about this, on whether or not they want to assume that federal eligibility determination process for SSI, and Oregon has assumed it. So there is an entity within the department that actually does the federal SSI determinations, but it's following all the federal rules and getting all of the medical examinations and so on. So it is a very lengthy process, but we are a part of the time it takes, the resources that are put to it.
Oh, and just further follow-up. Thank you. I guess the point I'm trying to make is, having worked with the chronically mentally ill and disabled, putting them through a two-year application process, just getting them on a bus to go to an appointment is difficult. So let alone, so I think that this may be, maybe I might be presuming wrong, a systems problem in assisting them in getting them on SSI. Yeah.
One last comment related to that is that we did have, although it's just ended, the General Assistance Program, which was basically a pre-SSI program using similar criteria to SSI and state workers, and then there would be some cash benefit to clients who qualified for that. And they worked actively with those individuals to help them through the actual SSI determination process. But that program ended January 31st, although, as Jim said, there is this other presumptive SSI eligibility process that's been put in place. I just don't know how many resources there are to aid clients through that process.
Representative Bates.
Just to add, shed more light, as I said in the committee last year, the last time around I did this, the program here in Oregon is funded by federal dollars, but there are state employees that do it, and they've been instructed to try to shorten the length of time it takes to make that determination, because during the time they're making the determination, the state is picking up their health care benefits and often paying out money on general assistance also. So they're trying to shorten that down. But the other catch here is, even after you get your SSI, there's an 18-month automatic delay in getting Medicare. So you have another year and a half in which you're probably going to qualify for Medicaid, and that has to be funded by the state until they finally make it to Medicare, which time they come off our rolls. So, Lynn, the question I'm leading up to, and this population we're seeing here, is this a flow-through population where it takes about 2 or 3 years to get somebody from this position through the process of getting SSI and then getting on Medicare, and is that a constant flow through of population?
There is a constant flow, although and some of it goes directly from this population to the SSI population. While we had a GA program, you would see a lot of movement over to the GA program, where there was the cash assistance to go along with the medical assistance. And there is analysis that's been done that Judy and her staff are expert on in terms of the flow of individuals between programs. And depending upon what information you want, we can provide information on that.
Once you go to it, you get to a good break.
Okay. That'll be coming up in two pages, I think. Page 29 takes those two populations together and says, if you're thinking just OHP standard, not about them as two kinds of groups of people, here's where the income distributes for that 100,000 eligible, with a little under 40% in the 0 to 10.
And then, Lynn, what was the dollar, total amount of dollars we spend on this population? Well, we haven't spent very much yet. I guess we're not gonna. But what was it projected to be?
I'm sorry, but I don't have that at the tip of my head. So we'll get, and that'll come back to the issue that Representative Bates.
Because we were spending money. A lot of this population was an OHP plus before,
right.
And it moved over to standard.
It was categorical.
Plus expanded. So.
And that's about a third of the overall.
About a fourth of the eligible.
Okay.
Well, but I'm going up here. I'm seeing percent of eligibles on the far left-hand side of your slide 29. At 37 or 8%.
Mm-hmm.
So what? How's a fourth? 25%.
I'm sorry. What?
A fourth of the eligibles would be 25.
I misunderstood your question. A fourth of the 400.
A fourth of the 400. About 100,000.
Yeah.
Okay.
The next page is just for your information. It's a distribution at a point in time of our Medicaid clients, Medicaid and CHIP clients.
Hold on. If it's a fourth, if it's 100,000 of the 400,000, why do we have a percent of eligibles on the right-hand side of that?
What this graph represents is the 100,000 eligible.
Oh,
and
of the 100,000.
Distribution of the 100,000.
Got it. Excuse me, it's simple. I just wasn't getting
it. You just don't live with it every day. And then on page 30 is just our point in time, November 2002, of how our clients are spread across the state by county and the an estimate of the dollars that are spent on a monthly basis by county and what percent that represents of the population in the county. So you could look at Jefferson County, Josephine, and Klamath are all in the 16 to 18% of the population is covered on the Oregon Health Plan. And then a low county would be up at Benton, Clackamas, and the 6 to 7% of the county population is covered by the Oregon Health Plan. And this mirrors to a large degree, of course, what the economic situation is in a given county.
Representative March.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The CHIP eligibles percent receiving benefits category, I mean, let's just take Jefferson, for example. You've got 0.94%. So does that mean less than 1% of the 175 on average are receiving benefits?
No. What this represents, those percents represent, is a percent of the population in that county. So
okay.
Less than 1% of the people who live in Jefferson County are served here.
Okay. Okay.
Program.
Okay. So, but not of the eligibles.
Right.
Okay.
That's
thank
right.
you.
And this would probably be a good place to stop because we then move into, we've talked about who is covered, and we would next move into what is covered, much of which we've already discussed, but it would be a reasonable stop.
We've done the eligibles. Next phase is benefit side.
Right. And then we move on from there to delivery and payment system.
Well, and we're going to want to do that, try and get our schedule together. I'm still waiting for a response to Representative Cruz's question about explaining the federal decision-making for federal
everything.
Health care policy.
Yeah, everything. For everything.
And he's agreed to stay while we work through that tonight.
Start with the
so we could invite Congressman Waxman here to give a discussion of why, when he was chairing the committee in the 1980s, in early 90s, why he was so hard on the Oregon Health Plan. But I can...
Well, I think
later.
Lynn alluded to some of that. My serious question is, can you explain in 10,000 words or less your understanding as it has been released and revealed, the Bush administration's changes in
proposed changes
in federal Medicaid and health care policy?
All right. I don't have my talking points with me, but we have an expert on our staff, Gretchen Morley, who has just come to work for the agency from the Office of Management and Budget, who actually was involved in some of the concepts that relate around that. So she's got knowledge of the program and contacts at the federal level in terms of understanding it. But her initial analysis has indicated that although the Bush administration is careful not to call it a block grant, it's basically two block grants, one that's long-term care, one that is the rest of your Medicaid program, including administration.
So, C. Allen, they're breaking it out.
And that's true.
That's right.
And these block grants would be based upon what you spent in federal fiscal year 2002. That's the period that ended September 30th, 2002. And your block grant would be able to grow in the upcoming years at a percent level. There's some additional money they load up front that goes into the block grant that you pay for at the out end. It's budget neutral to the federal government and its scoring. And they do it by loading it up front, taking the money away at the back end. You have to sign up for the entire 10 years. You commit your state, which is how they make out okay in the end. And there's a maintenance of effort. And the maintenance of effort is also based on what you spent in federal fiscal year 2002. And, you know, given our situation, we may not want to spend that amount of money. And that maintenance of effort grows over the 10-year period, but it grows at a lesser rate. It grows at the medical inflation rate.
As their contribution is declining.
Right.
Perfect.
But you're supposed to get a lot of flexibility with it. Flexibility to
no money.
You can operate in there to cover different people, more people. There's some guarantees you still have to have. Mandatory Medicaid services for mandatory Medicaid clients. They're not giving that up. But a lot of the flexibility that we've gained with our waivers for OHP2 would be easier to get in the future if you were in this block grant box. And supposedly some new flexibilities, kind of what do governors want to do? You know, it's all available to talk about, but has to pass Congress. There aren't any details yet. And past experience with CMS has been that they do come back. The legislation may be pretty flexible, but they come back with regulations that start to squeeze a bit in terms of what you can do.
Representative Cruz.
I think on this particular subject, I think a relevant point is when are we going to see this legislative package implemented, and is it relevant for what we're doing now? I personally have some questions over we're better off under the block grant than we are under the current system, and that's a decision we'll have to make. But one other point, we had asked a while ago to kind of see the different Medicaid funding stream matrices. I had asked Gene about that in my committee, and you're probably the one I should have asked. I mean, we've got the mandated, the optional, there's all these different pots of Medicaid money, different funding streams, and based on the work some of us are going to be entering in the next week, I think that would be really, really handy to have. So if there's any way you could get that to us this week.
It won't be OMAP who puts it together. I'm not sure. I should commit.
Okay. Well, I'm asking anybody I see from this point till the end of the week.
Well, I need to make sure I understand what it is you're looking for. Within the department, we have lots of Medicaid dollars, which Gene talked about last week. And you're looking to see where the strings are, how much money is in
How much money is in each category, and if we could, even those Medicaid funding sources in Department of Ed and stuff like that that, you know, I mean, because clearly at some point, if we're looking for a safety net, I think the Department of Ed Medicaid dollars fit into that matrix also. So,
yeah, and a lot of those dollars already run through our budget.
I understand that. But kind of the silos that they exist in, where they end up, and that sort of thing.
I understand the question.
Okay.
I was going to check to make sure you understand. Okay. Representative Bates.
I think we already covered it already. I'll hold the rest of my questions. We can see you back here on what day?
I don't know. We've got a couple other.
I'll hold my questions later.
Because we will definitely see Lynn back.
Or Lynn, yes.
Yeah, or Lynn.
Who will bring everyone with her?
Yeah. Any other questions? It's just good today. I mean, 3:30, 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock in the afternoon, you guys are very engaged.
That's why we have coffee and cookies.
Yeah. Actually, it was the M&Ms that did it for me, so thank you very much.
Kelly. See no other business to come before the committee. We are adjourned.